that's where sacrifice comes in, right? This is where we truly are called to lay down our life, to scatter these seeds, and only God gives the growth. It's not for us to decide which stories change our children's lives. It's not for us to decide which living ideas, you know, have the greatest impact. But we can trust that seeds planted will grow. Some of them will grow. The Holy Spirit will give growth to something, and that we are just seeking to be faithful and give our children, you know, the best that has been thought and said. And yet, because they are, you know, normal human beings, they will not, you know, fall down and worship every time, because we are all of us don't as much as we should.
The Commonplace is a podcast for the new homeschooling mom delighted by the ideals and principles of a classical Charlotte Mason education, but who feels unsure of how to get started on the practical side of nourishing a soul on the good, the true, and the beautiful. I hope you find camaraderie here as we get our bearings in the world of old ideas and old books, of wisdom and virtue, and of the means of grace by which God works in this world through the commonplaces, which includes your home. So, if you're like me, trying to offer your children an education unlike your own, and wondering if you can create an atmosphere, a discipline, and a life of such richness, I'm here to tell you, I think you can. I'm your host, Autumn Kern, and I'm pleased to welcome you to The Commonplace. Welcome back to The Commonplace. My name is Autumn. And as you know, this fourth season, we are answering questions about story. And I have special guests. I have two of them today. Please welcome to the podcast, Mrs. Amanda Foss and Mrs. Brooke Johnson. Hey, ladies, welcome back.
Hello.
It's good to be here.
So if you don't remember, Amanda and Brooke joined me in season two to talk about how to start a classical Charlotte Mason co-op. They were both doing this in their local communities, and it was so fun to have them then, and I'm really excited to have them back now. First, because these are my people. So when I want to talk about classical educational philosophy, I want to talk about boots on the ground, actually engaging in ideas with my kids. These are my girls. This is my text thread. This is my Voxer thread. These are the people that I go to first and foremost. And so I know how wise they are. I'm delighted to have them back. But they've also just concluded their first season. They worked together on a podcast called The Wonder Years, where they focused on bringing classical philosophy into the realm of the 0 to 6 age kids, the really young ones, and showing how you can build out an entire home and life with these ideas and principles, no matter the age of your young children. And so for today's particular question, they were the perfect people to invite on the show. So before we get into the question of the day, I would love for you both to introduce yourselves. So Amanda, if you'll kick us off by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came through the classical wardrobe.
Yes, I would love to. So I am a mom of 5. I've been married to my husband, Patrick, for 13 years almost. I was a homeschool student myself. I'm the oldest of 13 kids, all homeschooled. Yes, my mom is a superhero. And so because of that, I was very aware of classical education and classical students all throughout my childhood. I was not classically educated, but my mom was reading Charlotte Mason. Her ideas were very much in the air of our homeschool. There are many things that I look back on and think, oh, I'm really glad my mom did that. And then later I found out, oh, well, that's because that was Charlotte Mason. Yeah. So I'm very thankful for that background. But honestly, before becoming an adult, my idea of classical education was that it was the snobby kids who did Latin and were really puffed up and proud. And so not necessarily a positive vision. But then 9 years ago, actually, before I was even a mother, I don't think I was even pregnant at the time. I just had a lazy weekend and my parents were going to the Great Homeschool Convention and they were like, hey, you want to come? And I'm like, I'm a homeschooler. Nerdy lectures from people who are smart. This is totally my jam. So I went with them and got to hear Dr. Christopher Perrin for the first time. And so hearing him, he just planted some ideas in my mind that whatever version of classical education that I thought it was, there was at least another version out there. And so then later, as my children were born and I began exploring educational options for my kids, as you say, Autumn, I went through the wardrobe and I have not been able to come out.
Yep, absolutely. I think that will resonate with many. You can't come back out once you've gone in. At least you're not the same if you try to come back out. Okay, so Brooke, passing over to you, if you will do the same, tell us a little bit about you, your family, and then how you came through the classical wardrobe.
Okay, so very different from Amanda. which is why I love her and love to talk about her. And I am always just so, every time she says she has, I guess it would be 12 brothers and sisters, I'm just like, your mom is amazing. It is just amazing. But yeah, so I am married to my husband, Mitch. We have been married for almost 12 years. We have two boys that are 7 and 5 and a lot of fun. My husband is a pastor, and so he actually just moved into a different role that is taking a lot more of his time, a lot more of our time here at home. And so it has been a joy transitioning to that role with him, where he is over his own campus and his own people. And it has just been a delight. It's something that I knew when I met him all these years ago that one day he would be pastoring a people. And so just to see him even in that role now has just been a true delight to watch him grow in that. And so, but I did not grow up in a Christian home. And so for me, I did not become a Christian until my freshman year of college. And so I went to the small college that was a Christian school, but it was on a soccer scholarship. So it wasn't even, to be honest, for college at the time. It was just kind of the next phase. And just to be completely honest, it was getting me away from home, which was my biggest aim at that point in my life. And so, yeah. And so I ended up at this small Christian school, and God saved me. I mean, that's just all there is to it. I was not looking for him at the time. And so he saved me and then transformed me. And so the only thing at that point that mattered to me is I just wanted to learn more about him. And so I then enrolled in all the theology and Bible classes and started to learn. And I remember being, you know, 20, 21 and hearing about God and his world and this world that he made. And just sitting there with all these other students and just wondering, how are they in their chairs? How are they not sobbing? How is this, you know, not just overwhelming them? And so I met my husband while we were there. We got married while I was still in college. And we just started ministry right away. And I don't know whose idea that was. It was probably not a wise one, but it was the path that the Lord had for us. And so we got married and started ministry. And we have been doing that for the last a little over 14 years. And so in our engagement time, he was already on staff at a church and everything. And so, yeah, so I can remember being in churches where people were homeschooling. And I was so intrigued by it. I loved the idea. And to be honest with you, more from a family culture formation. And largely because I did not have that. So that was the interest up front, was just the formation I saw in the children and the family culture. So I was interested. But then it wasn't until I had my first son. And I remember at that time, Sarah Clarkson had released a podcast that is not a podcast anymore. It's not going, but called Storyform. And I had just started reading one of Sally Clarkson's books and just listening and learning and thinking, this is what I want to do. Because for me, it was just the next step of formation, which in the circle that I was in, I was thinking a lot about how does discipleship and formation happen, but I was not thinking about it from an educational standpoint. It was just from a discipleship formation. How do you form, you know, a person? And being able to hold my son, I was thinking, I don't want to give this up to anybody else. Like, I want to be the one that gets to do all of this and help. And of course, we have help. So that was it. And then at the same time, another ministry started, Risen Motherhood, which is, you know, maybe some moms have heard of that. But I subscribed to their newsletter. And I always have to say this, because at that time, there was this delightful writer, and she was so funny. And I just loved everything about it. And her name was Autumn Kern. And so I just remember following Autumn Kern at that point on Instagram, and fast forward several years. And I'm now thinking, my oldest son is now old enough to start homeschooling. So I'm visiting all the co-ops. I'm visiting the neoclassical co-ops, and I don't know what to do, to be honest. I'm thinking I'm going to do this. I've not read a lot of like educational philosophy books. And then I see on an Instagram feed, and I have a lot to say about Instagram, but this is one really good thing that God sovereignly did on this day, where Autumn Kern that Risen Motherhood newsletter girl is going to start a podcast. And I was like, perfect. She's doing exactly what I'm doing. She's going to try to blend Charlotte Mason and classical. And I love these ideas. And how is she going to do it? Let me hop in her DMs. And so I did that. And so I just entered the wardrobe truly through the commonplace. And so it was really just that I really started to understand. And as you just walk through, and I can remember the episode, the moral imagination, the mythic and moral, episode 7, season 1, the doors flew wide open. And just as Amanda said, I've not come out. And I don't think that I will. I have no plans to anyway. So
thank you. And thank God. It's so good. I love that we all started our conversations around the time that the commonplace kind of launched. It was your early support and willingness to talk to me on Instagram for both of you, actually, that furthered into Voxer conversations. And then I introduced you two. And then you had this amazing project, The Wonder Years, last year. And we've just continued this conversation around these ideals and this pursuit of what is true, good, and beautiful with our children for the glory of God, but also to not have that divide. Brooke, I love you because you're someone who in the classical world has the ability to still cry about how good God is, but now it's all whole rather than it being like church theology class. God did these things, but over here is school. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of the coming through the wardrobe bit is when you can see it all together. But I love that you still have that response. And that's what's so beautiful about this, in particular with the early years when our kids are, you know, by God design, really open to our influence, to our instruction, to loving what we love and different things like that. And so we're going to focus in on this younger crowd today and the story of the day. So the question about story for the day. So today's question, I hear it in a couple of different ways. People will ask me things like, what do I do if my kids are looking out of the window when I'm reading aloud to them? Are they paying attention at all? Or should I stop and define these words for them while I'm reading because they probably don't know them? Or should I even tell them what's happening in the story? I think it's above their head. And what I think is at the heart of these sorts of messages and concerns from moms is basically, do my little kids even understand this story? We have this beautiful heritage of great stories, wonderful list about excellent literature that we want to give to our young kids. And a lot of moms are worried their kids don't understand. So that's the question of the day. That's why you guys are here. So as we get started, I'm going to kick it back to you guys and ask for a 101 on what understanding looks like in the early years.
Yeah, that picture you just described is a very relatable one. And I think especially when you're first starting out in this process called classical education, like you said, I remember sitting down with a stack of year one books with my oldest daughter and reading some of them and being like, oh my goodness, like this has like some antiquated language. Like, you know, I don't know that I necessarily up until that point had super prepared her for that. And we just dove in and I was just really trusting wiser people than myself at that point going like, I really believe in the philosophy that I've been hearing people like Dr. Perrin talking about, people like the Scholae sisters, all these wise people. And so I'm just going to go with it. I'm going to dive in. At that point, I was using the Ambleside online year one. And so we just dove into these books that were hard. And there were absolutely times where, whether it was looking out a window or looking off into space, kind of that glazed look at times might have come into her eyes. And yet what was so neat about it was that as I trusted that process, I saw within 6 months a major transformation take place in her. Mm-hmm. And so I went in very hardcore Charlotte Mason style on that front end of I was not giving any additional feedback. I was not telling her vocabulary words, nothing. I was just like, I'm just going to read it to you and just drop it there. I've since then grown a little more flexible, but I think that was a good place to start. You know, I think all of us as moms need to know our ditch, and my ditch would definitely be to overtalk because I'm a chatty person. I love talking. I love talking about books. And so it was important for me and my personality to kind of just put that guard up early on and be like, I'm just going to let the book speak for me. And so one thing I'll say, though, that at that time and watching that process is that we really need to begin with a definition of understanding. What is it to understand? And I heard this a while ago and I loved it so much. So the wise person who said it, and I can't even remember who it was now, some classical person brought up the point that to understand is to stand under something. And so I think we can properly say that a child has understanding when we see them receiving it into themselves in a way that is non-analytical and judgy. Like sometimes you read a child a book and they're being very critical of it. Like, well, why is that? What's this? Like, and I would say that child does not understand the book yet. But when a child is just taking in the story, even if they're less verbal about it, right? My son is in first grade this year, and it has just taken me back to that first year with my daughter. She's now in third grade. And let me tell you, the difference in narration from a third grader and a first grader is night and day. Mm-hmm. It's a process. Like, you don't start with a six-year-old who can narrate, you know, six pages of reading in one sitting. You have to start with paragraphs. You have to start very small, and you slowly grow and expand from there. And so the thing that I'm looking for, especially with him in these early days where he really is having to get oriented with the vocabulary, I think in a perfect world, Mason's lessons, you know, if you follow Mason's structure of lessons, you would present some vocabulary words on the front end of a lesson, having done the pre-reading, knowing what words need to be discussed. That doesn't always happen in my reality. So at times I am having to maybe give a definition in the middle. Also, I've noticed kids will ask, you know, they'll say like, oh, what does that word mean? Which again is showing that they're receiving the story, right? They're listening, they're attending enough to notice a word that they don't understand. And so I don't ever let, like, even if there's 10 words, you know, in a paragraph that they don't understand, I don't trip up over it. It's not like I'm stopping every word. You know, if it's a word that is so significant to the story that I'm like, if they miss this concept, they have missed the whole point. Okay, then I might pause to explain that. But all that to say, to go back to that idea of reception, you know, as long as our children are taking the story into themselves and, you know, maybe their narration, you know, it's your six-year-old and his narration of your story is, well, there was this guy and he went to that place and yeah, that's what I remember. And you're like, okay.
Thank you for that narration.
Yeah. I love having now my first and third together for form one where I can be like, okay, into the or what? Yeah, she can give this brilliant narration. So I'm thankful to have that, you know, model there. But even with her, she had no model. There was no other person to show her how to do big narrations. And so she just had to learn slowly over time. We learned together. And watching them just take the stories into themselves and realizing even then, maybe later at dinner, that story that my son gave, that one sentence narration, he's then telling his dad the full story. So it's very interesting to me that I also think we have to take into consideration that children often need time to process. And so even if they look at the time like they were, you know, where I don't know where we expect them to look, you know, if they're listening to a read aloud, if they're not playing with something, they're going to be staring at a wall or staring off in a way that maybe does look like they're not paying attention. But at the same time, realizing that that also might just be them trying to integrate all that information they just heard. Like, it's a lot for their brains to do that. It takes a lot of effort. You know, it's like digesting a meal. And so don't be surprised. Actually, that was one of my favorite memories of year one, was that my daughter gave really impressive narrations at her final end of the year exam about stories that went back even to the first term. Stories that at that time she was giving those one sentence narrations. And then 9 months later, she's giving me in-depth details. Oh, I love that story. All these things happened. And I was just blown away. So you know, again, I think we have to remember that education begins with humility. And so what I'm looking for more than anything with my children is a humble reception. You know, I'm looking for them to show up to their lessons to read with joy, right? If they're grumpy, trying to like work out the hard issues there before we begin reading, because if they're in that grumpy state, they're not going to be able to receive what I'm giving them. And then just let the Holy Spirit do the work from that point. And what I'll add for a little bit upper, once you get into that maybe third, fourth, fifth grade, is that then from there, understanding not only looks like reception, but they do start to begin interpretation or integration. How, you know, there's different words for it, but they're going to start noticing things about the story. They're going to start asking questions about the story. You're going to see them start synthesizing what they're hearing in these stories with their experiences in the world. They're going to ask questions about why characters do certain things or the consequences of that. Or, you know, we've introduce conversations about images, right? Like, oh, well, why do you think in this story with Snow White that she ate a poison apple? Can you think of any stories that also have an apple that killed somebody? Like, you know, just little questions like that to kind of just get her starting on the path to think. But I don't give her the answers. I'm just asking questions. And she's honestly, the way I think you know a student's there is because they're asking those questions. You don't have to ask very many because they're busy doing the asking. And then you just get to be a joyful participant in that conversation.
Yeah, that's great. No, thank you for all of that. I love the emphasis there on that sometimes the, I'm going to say cognitive output, which is not the way we would think of it as classical educators, but might be the way that a lot of moms are used to assessing something when you read would be like, this is the output that I got right from the start, maybe the narration, whatever. This is what I can see immediately. And often with young kids, especially, we need to allow that time because the way they first approach or interact with a story is in a more sensory way. So it's more emotive, it's less cognitive, it's less analytical, and it has to work there before it can come out in a sentence or in their play or some other way that a mom might actually see the connections being made. So whether you're at the formal table and you're looking for a narration at the end of the year for your exams, like with your example with your oldest, or if you then just see them playing in the backyard or talking to dad over dinner, something that's a little more of that all of life approach that we have, we first need to give them that time and space too, which I think is really important. Brooke, have you noticed anything like that with your boys when they're engaging with story, that time lapse being really important?
I think so. I think something else that's really important to start with is just understanding mom's ideal of what this is going to look like and be like. And I do not have a daughter, but I am around a lot of little girls. And I can just tell you from a boy perspective and starting out with a boy is that really understanding. And I think there's a lot that is now being, you know, developed that we now have that, you know, really helps us understand what is happening in a boy's mind and how are they learning? How are they taking in information? And a lot of times what we are now reading developmentally is that there needs to be a lot of movement or there needs to be, you know, that's how they're learning. But if we, you know, look or, you know, print out a book list and see this list or maybe see a friend share something online, because that's just how we are introduced to a lot of these ideas today, then we can, you know, really in a way that is unhelpful to the people in front of us, kind of put this ideal on them to say, this is the way you're going to learn. This is the book you're going to read. This is the order it's going to be. And ask me how I know that, because I just kind of was new to all of this and learning and just really forced my oldest to do a lot of things that just were not developmentally appropriate and just really not loving to him. So I just think you having to understand your family and your family culture. And then just like Amanda said so beautifully, is that when you are really thinking about and choosing these books, that you really can trust that whatever is happening as you're reading, right? We know that a lot of the language, we had the same thing happen to us when we started year one. I thought I was doing a pretty good job of reading, you know, good books to them. And I think we were. They had a lot of Bible. So like I was good there, but then not a lot of anything else. And so it was a huge jump for him of just understanding and all of that. But what was amazing is that what I found was hard for me was not hard for him. And so I think it was just having to have my appetites trained to good literature and good writing and good, what is the method and the philosophy behind all of this? It took me a longer time to understand it than it did him. If that makes sense. So you might be having a harder time doing it because you don't really enjoy it. And I think just like being honest about that, like as quick as you can and just saying, but again, like we're trusting the people before us. We're trusting this long tradition that said these really are the best books and the best tools, and then allowing them to have that movement and to have that time. And so read alouds for us may look very different than they do for you or for you. But I think if I were just to look or maybe to step into your house and see the way you do it, I could feel really nervous. Like, okay, now I'm doing it wrong. But the reality is, you know, these are my children and God has called me to teach them and I'm responsible for them. And then there's really is a freedom when you have your philosophy in place to say, we can continue working at this, even if it's kind of clunky at first. And I think it's just going to be like I was not prepared for that. I thought this was all going to be, I had my philosophy, I had the books, I had it printed, and I was just not prepared for the clunkiness of it. But I wish I, you know, starting with my second student who will start this coming year, there really is just a peace that I have with him. Like, he's not having the year one that my first did. And I still feel a little bad about it, but I hear enough from moms that say that's true of every first time, you know, student with your first one. So I don't feel too bad, but yeah.
What you're saying, Brooke, is reminding me of how Mason talks about how each child will only take in what they're ready for at each moment, right? Yeah. So we might read them a book, yeah, and each student in the room who's listening might take a little different thing. Yeah. It's not that truth is subjective. The truth of the story is, mm-hmm, still objective, but which objective truth, which thing that is impacting each child might be a little different because they're a different human being. And, you know, it also reminded me of something that when you first told us, Autumn, that we were going to talk about this topic, the conversation we had at that time was how we put way too much pressure on this idea of understanding in the first place. Like, yeah, God is talking to you all day, every day. He is speaking in images and in words and in sounds and stories. And 99% of the time, you're not listening. So if, right, you don't listen to God very well, don't be surprised if your student doesn't always listen to you very well. They are made in your image. And so I think just even accepting that like, that is a beautiful, maybe not beautiful, maybe it's a fallen part, but it is a part of being in a fallen world, is that what's beautiful is that we can just have grace towards our children, recognizing that and realizing that it's okay. Like, you know, I think as a mom, maybe we can easily, it can become about us, right? Like, well, I'm not reading. Probably more than once I have said something to the effect of, I'm not reading to hear myself speak. And yet, really the pride in that of like, you're wasting my time, right? I'm not worrying about half so much about you missing out so much as I could be doing other things if we're just not going to pay attention today. And yet, that's where sacrifice comes in, right? This is where we truly are called to lay down our life to scatter these seeds. And only God gives the growth. It's not for us to decide which stories change our children's lives. It's not for us to decide which living ideas, you know, have the greatest impact. But we can trust that seeds planted will grow. Some of them will grow. The Holy Spirit will give growth to something, mm-hmm, and that we are just seeking to be faithful and give our children, you know, the best that has been thought and said. And yet, because they are, you know, normal human beings, they will not, you know, fall down and worship every time, because we are all of us don't as much as we should.
Yeah, I would love to actually bring what you both just said together. So Brooke, your point that moms need to check their own ideals and even our own good-hearted eagerness when we get started with homeschooling. Mm-hmm. So when we have those like 3, 4, 5 year olds. And then Amanda, what you were talking about in honestly just following the grain, as Mason would say, like working with the actual child in front of you, making sure you're giving to them what, kind of like when we think about food, the right things, the right time and the right amount, and the right way, I think is the other one. Like these two things coming together, because I think it was from Misty Winkler. It was a long time ago where she had this blog post and she said, the most eager homeschooling mom you will ever find is one of a 3-year-old. And I think I had a 2-year-old at the point and was pretty ready to order some pre-K curriculum to start with her because she was super smart. And I was just like ready to go. And I was like, oh, that's me. And so I think for a lot of moms, they feel this pressure as they get in that 3, 4, 5 age to like do the real stuff. They're so excited. They've maybe been studying Mason or they've been studying philosophy and they're ready to do the real stuff. And yet, to Amanda's point, young children have this birthright for this really rich early years. You have to actually feed them and plant the seeds at that time that are appropriate for that season of life. And so we have this idea in classical education called poetic knowledge. It comes up a little bit throughout the season from a lot of different angles. And so I want to ask you guys, why in these early years, before we start formal school, do we really need to pause and focus on poetic knowledge, maybe rather than analytic or some other type that comes later for the early years? Why is it so foundational?
Go for it, and then I'll follow up.
Well, I can't wait to hear what Amanda says about this, because she is my girl that I ask when I'm like, remind me again what you're even saying or what this is. But I will just say that one thing that really stood out to me, and it is a quote by Stratford Caldecott, and it says, to be enchanted by story is to be granted a deeper insight into reality. And when I read that maybe a year ago, I just remember thinking, man, isn't that true? Because just going back to what we just said, is that a lot of times we will think, you know, is my child ready for this? And I think there is a part where we do consider the readiness, like, is this story right now appropriate at this age? Because there's some really sweet spots where you can just line up where they are and give them something. But specifically with the littlest, I think that when they have a rich diet of Bible, and then all these things Amanda is about to tell you about, it does not take away from who God is in even the smallest degree, but it just makes the world bigger and wider. And just from someone who entered the classical wardrobe as an adult, didn't read a lick of fiction for a solid 10 years. I mean, truly, I was practical theology all the way for a solid 10 years. And those muscles were pretty strong. I could have a decent, you know, conversation. I could defend some positions and all of those things. But there was another part of me in my soul, like my interior self, that was languishing. And I did not know that because I was growing and feeding and all of that until I read the Chronicles of Narnia. And I cannot talk about it without crying, because what happened is that God did not get smaller. He just got bigger. And I saw him everywhere. And I think a lot of times we begin this, you know, with the wrong question. We're afraid that we're going to take away from God if we spend time building our interior selves, thinking about the imagination, that somehow that's going to diminish him. And I can just say, it's just not true. It's not the way we were formed as persons. It's not the way that God has made us as image bearers, people who are made in his image, but are word people. So one quote that I pulled from like three different people says this. Well, I pulled it together, so I don't know who I would give credit to, but to be human and made in the image of God is to be people of words. And we are formed by words, whether we read stories or not. Part of becoming a person who is being conformed to Christ is choosing which words you will use to form your and your children's lives. Go ahead, Amanda.
I just love it, because everything you're saying there about the importance of words, the importance of stories, that we're not giving our children less, we're giving them more, that is fully connected to poetic knowledge. So let me begin by defining it for anyone who's not familiar with the idea. So poetic knowledge is a non-analytical, sensory, emotional type of knowledge. So a super simple example I like to give is, if an apple was sitting on your table, anybody could see the apple, right? But it's not automatically poetic knowledge just because you saw the apple. But if you picked up the apple, you touched it in your hands, you smelled it, maybe you took a bite of it, maybe it reminded you in that moment of Genesis 3. And although it does not say it was an apple, we all think apple because of all the children's Bibles we read growing up. And so in that moment, your mind is transported to that story. If you were to pause and think about appleness, or to think of other stories of apples, right? Like, there's all this contemplation that could be invoked by one apple if you went there. Now, many of us often do not go there, so that's the problem. But it's a potentiality that exists in almost every object, right? Is this option, this opportunity to see and to know it on a deeper level, and to contemplate and to have what really then becomes this emotional response, right? Of whether it's delight or wonder, maybe awe or even fear, right? If it's something grand, like standing in front of a waterfall, you might for a moment just feel like overwhelmed how small you are and how big the God who makes waterfalls is, right? So this would be a sensory emotional type of knowledge. It's the first type of knowledge a human being has. So a baby, when they are first born, and they are snuggling up to their mother's breast as they eat, they're just basking in her love, right? Like, they're living in this love that is a human being who has a body who is caring for them, and it's looking in their eyes, right? It's laughing with them and trying to get that first laugh. Like, this begins from the beginning, where the child is in such a receptive state to the world that they are so easily delighted, right? It's such a beautiful thing of babies and toddlers is the world is just full of wonder for them. Everything is amazing. Everything is magic. They have, you know, that's why they ask so many questions about fairy tales, because they're still living in a world where everything is a fairy tale. Like, this is all wild. Cars moving down the street, magic. Like, it's all amazing. It's all full of wonder for them. And so children naturally live in this poetic mode. And so now how that connects to story, though, is that stories, like Brooke said, are made up of words, and words are made up of metaphors. If you go back to the primitive roots of most words, they generally have some sort of concrete word that, what am I trying to say here? A concrete noun that they are coming from, or a verb, right? Some sort of noun or an action verb, whether it's in the Latin or the Greek, that goes back to the original meaning of that word, because we speak the language of metaphor. Everything we are conveying in our language is built up out of really the creation. Like, we have words reflecting the world God has made. And so the sad thing is, if you have a child who has not been out in nature, right, hasn't, you know, climbed on rocks and hasn't played in the dirt and hasn't, you know, laid in the sun and looked at the clouds, these are all experiences that are so important for them to understand words. They will be limited in their understanding of language if they are kept from experiencing the natural world. That is just, you cannot overcome that. Now, it's not to say a child will have no knowledge, but a child whose only encounter with nature is through, say, television, that's not a real encounter, right? Like, a child who has seen, you know, whales and fish and all these amazing things in an ocean documentary, it's not that that has no place. It's not that it might not interest them. It might, you know, awaken some sort of curiosity about what could be out there, but they don't know whales. They don't know fish, right? Until they've gone and stood in the ocean and tasted the saltiness of the water. Like, they're still missing important, necessary building blocks of their world. Autumn, you often use the language of, you know, going through the wardrobe. And I probably the metaphor I tend to rely more heavily on is just the idea of like building a world. Like, you're building a world for your child. And we all are born with a very small world. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? Like, a baby's whole world is his mother or her mother. Yeah. But we don't want it to stay that way, right? Like, you know, an 18-year-old whose whole world is their mother is a very unhealthy 18-year-old. And so we want their world to grow and expand, right? And so we do this through getting them out in God's world, through giving them rich experiences, and just in its most basic form, getting them outside. Because all of these things are working together to give them an understanding of language so that when you come and read the books, they have a basis to interpret those words. And, you know, obviously connected to that is you as a parent using your words to name all those things when you're out and about. You know, I love that with Charlotte Mason Classical Education, we do nature study, but it has also been the most stretching part of educating my children for me, because I don't think I knew more than five trees before doing nature study with my kids. Every tree was a tree, you know. It was like, well, that one's like a Christmas tree, and that one's like, you know, the one, the eucalyptus, right? They use that for wedding bouquets, I think. You know, I had such a limited knowledge, and yet the beauty of getting outside and you know, using my little app to look up, identify this, oh, okay, you know, this is, you know, a Tanzanian blue eucalyptus, like whatever it might be, to learn to name things with my children so that then when we're going back to the books, their understanding of things is, oh, you know, that's a hill, that's a mountain, that's snow, that's sunlight. It is, again, just building out their understanding of the real world so that then when they go into a story, those initial poetic encounters with creation will then inform a poetic encounter with books. We often, you know, we think of poetic knowledge in terms of your experience of reality, which it is. But you also can have poetic knowledge in dialogue, right? Like, you can have an emotional response to something you're hearing, to something you're seeing with your eyes. So we don't want to all, you know, forget that part either, that is actually a part of reading. Is this, how often have we read the book and had that sensory emotional response, right? Like, we just have all the feels, we feel warm and fuzzy, or we're mad, or, you know, we want to hurt that person who's hurting the person we love in this book that we're so deeply invested in. You know, we can feel very strong things through literature. Our children can feel very strong things through literature. And I do think that is a type of poetic knowledge as well. So realizing that all of those things are connected, it is not your child missing out on anything to delay going deeply into literature, you know, until they're in their formal lesson years. You're still reading them books, you know, you're looking at picture books, you're maybe reading Winnie the Pooh or I think I read my kids Pinocchio when my oldest was 5, you know. So there's little ones you can start to just gently introduce them to chapter books. Especially once you have an older and younger ones, you know, the younger ones end up hearing like all the good books when they're like 3 because you know, you're already reading them and they're right there. But that's a beautiful thing for them to hear them. And then later they'll get to read them again and be like, wait, I remember this when you read it, you know, that first time. And yeah, it's just a very organic, natural process that in some sense, until you're living it, it is hard to describe because it's so beautiful and so rich that like so often I like look at my children's lives and I'm like, people just don't even know how beautiful and good education can be. And I'm not saying like it's perfect, right? Like we are a bunch of sinners in this house. Like, you know, many times we have had to call in the principal, AKA dad, to, you know, get things in order, you know? And yet what is possible when you are reading great books, you know, not necessarily the great books. When I say great books, I'm meaning like, you know, good children's books. But when you're reading them, when you're enjoying them, delighting in them together, when you're talking about them, like it's just, it's so good and it's so beautiful. And, you know, I want it for everybody. That's the thing. When you tasted it, you're like, everybody needs this. This is what the world, it'll heal the world. Stories will save the world.
Yeah. I can't remember now if either of you had a very memorable experience with this, but the first time I came across Mason's point in home education that you shouldn't be reading a lot of stories to really young kids, I remember being flabbergasted by that section and thinking, what could she possibly mean by this? Like, of course you need to read them great books. But ultimately, as I kept studying Mason, I realized her point there and the principle to take was that children need to be interacting with things in as much as they can. Like if you don't live near the ocean, I understand you can't go to the ocean, but you can go to the creek, the park, things like that. If you're going to read a book about a fish, it is much better just to go looking for a fish when you were a young, very young, pre-formal age student. And that was really encouraging and helpful for me in those early years. Like I said, I was the mom who felt really eager to do the real stuff, get into the important things that matter sort of thing, the way A.A. Milne would like capitalize that, right? Important things that matter. And really what I needed to be doing, and we did plenty of, and I'm grateful for, was snuggling with my kids and taking them outside and laying in the grass and looking at the clouds and naming what we could see and being out in the woods and exploring together. And then, of course, reading good picture books. Like, we did need to read good books. And Mason was not against, if anyone's new here, Mason's not against reading great books to young kids. She just was building out this poetic knowledge that would eventually become the formal studies where she says children learn from books and things. The things are still there. They don't disappear when you turn 7. What I love about a Mason timetable, particularly for like nature study or geography, is that you have some time at the table reading your Burgess, doing your geography, doing your sand tray. And then there's all this empty space over the course of a term because she expected you to be out of doors looking for these things, going and experiencing these things. So it is very much the foundation, one, to reality, how your child will understand that, even in a way they can't express for a long time, how large you make the world, like you guys said. But then also it is building into that future education. I know the three of us have talked before that you can't really engage with those liberal arts if you haven't had a rich foundation of a poetic knowledge. You actually can't jump into classical education without this. So I'm so glad you guys were able to share on that. It was so encouraging. When we think about then the stories that we do want to read to our little kids, because like I just said, you should be reading to little kids. What are the areas that a mom with the pre-formal years should focus on, whether that be specific genres or ideas? What do you guys think is most important?
Well, Brooke and I did a whole episode on this on the Wonder Years, so I am just going to throw that out there because we spent over an hour going over like literally any book we could think of for this.
I will put that in the episode notes. So anything that I know they've taught on and talked about will be linked in today's episode notes. I haven't said that. Just go and check those as well.
Perfect. Yeah. So definitely go there. But what I'll just give a brief summary of what we discussed there, which is that you'll hear a million times if you stay around the classical world long enough, which is that we are to give our children folk tales, fairy tales, myths, legends, fables. So that's what we would say, give your children. And this starts, you know, maybe when they're little, you know, when maybe a 2-year-old or even before that. But if you get like the Stratford Caldecott picture books or Beatrix Potter, those are some great ones. My children love the I think it's Gaudone or Galdone, one of those. Paul Gaudone folk tales. So it's like the Little Red Hen, the Three Billy Goats Gruff. I'm not kidding. I read one of those every day. And honestly, to me, they're not like my favorite as far as illustrations go. Like they're fine, but for some reason, like I have multiple versions of Rumpelstiltskin. I have multiple versions of the Little Red Hen and the Paul Gadone ones are the ones they always bring me. So for whatever reason, I'm like, there's something in those books because they have magic for my children. And then I'll just say one book that I did not mention in that episode that we recorded. But since then, just the more research I do, I'm becoming very passionate about. And that is specifically the Everyman's Library Children's Classic version of the Aesop's Fables. So I'm doing a deep dive and study on John Sr. I'm actually working on a curriculum for the elementary years based off of his 1,000 good books list. But with that, he really harps on the importance of translations. And I think that's something that I knew was important, but I didn't necessarily realize how important until I started buying the copies he recommended and seeing the difference between the books I already had and the ones he recommends. So I highly recommend that version. That's a great one because it's not difficult to access compared to some of the other books he recommends that are like, you know, super old and, you know, really hard to find used copies. But that's an easy one to track down. And so I would definitely recommend that because that is an Aesop's Fables that you really can use up and through middle school. If anyone who's familiar with the Progymnasmata, which is like the classical writing curriculum, it begins with fables. So you're going to be needing to have a fables book for all of their elementary years up into middle school. And his book has the fables, then it has the moral, and then it has a reflection. And so that's something that I think is actually really helpful to begin in form one, right? Just reading the fable, go into form two, maybe add in the moral. And then by middle school, you can then even be going into those reflections and just really helping your student learn how to think and how to work through ideas and process stories. And how does these stories in a fable form connect to real life and how real people act? So really helpful stuff there. So I would highly recommend that copy.
That's great. Thank you for that. Brooke, do you have anything you want to add?
Well, I would just say, and I think that this is from Sarah Clarkson, is that children accept the world that they are given. And so if you want a rich, you know, pre-formal, if we're talking about the littlest, then just begin by picking up a book and reading to them for as long as they will, you will hold their attention. And it will be longer than you think. So if you have really good books, really good illustrations. So we're not saying that, you know, those things don't matter. But again, as Amanda talks about, you need to be able to recognize like which ditch you'll fall into. So are you going to like only wait and hold off until you find the most perfect language and pictures and all of that so you're not reading? Or are you going to just kind of read anything and you're like forming those appetites? And so there is a place where you're just, you know, there are, you heard Amanda, I wasn't sure if she was going to say it, but she is working on a curriculum. And so I just want to make that very loud and clear. And so be looking for that. But, you know, look at these lists and really start working from them in a way that there's just a freedom. And what I mean by that is I can remember before formal lessons being so worried I was going to read a book that was then going to be assigned for school. And so then I would like hold off. Whereas there are so many swaps that you're able to make. Now, I'm not saying that as someone who knows that because I do not do this well. But this is when I talk to Amanda, who says it's okay that you make, you know, you swap books and change things out. But so I think that part too, but just realizing that children really do accept the world that they are given. And so if you want a home culture of reading and delighting in these ideas, then you just start when they are infants. When you are nursing that baby, start reading. This is not something that I did very well. We have always read the Bible to our children. I think a lot of Christian families do. I think that's obviously, it is the most foundational. It is the living book. It is where we know Christ. It is the Word made flesh, all of those things that we would all, you know, if you are a Christian, you would say yes to. And so my boys had a constant diet of that, which is essential, right? So the classical tradition will say Bible, myths, fairy tales, fables, legends are essential. These are the tools that you are going to have in order to move up. And so the only way that I can just encourage a mom is that I remember when I first became a mom and I was looking to moms who had teenagers and thinking, that's where I want to go. Like, I want children as teenagers that love to read and delight in these ideas. And I still know those teenagers who are now young adults and we talk about them. They now send my boys books and it is just a delight that they are delighting in these ideas with my children. But I just remember thinking, if that's where I'm headed, what do I need to do? And that mom was so gracious to me to say, you have to begin now with your infant. Not thinking like they're going to be 12. So what are things you want him to love? Start doing that now and make that a practice. And that was some of the most foundational. Again, she wasn't talking about education, but it was the principle that I said, okay, if I want a delightful teenage boy, because I'm going to have two of them, then what are things I need to do? And she would always say, do the hard work now. Like, you know, train in habit of attention, sit them on your lap and read, train them in obedience, you know, again, forming the culture that makes this normal so that when they then get to that stage, just developmentally, where they are making choices on their own, they have worked those muscles. And this is just where their appetites are. And so what I then was able to do is then say, okay, well, if that's a principle and that is true of just the formation, again, I was thinking in terms of discipleship, but that is what the classical world did, is it showed me that, no, there's a way that humans are formed from the earliest stage, and you really can train them. And I know we don't like to use that term, but if you just think, I mean, this is historically, you can train appetites and you can do that. And so having to, just having watched it from the littlest, you know, in my own home, has also really had me rethink a lot of other things that in my mind I thought was so black and white, you know, from my practical theology days of this is how things are and this is how they work. But actually having human beings in my home from birth has really showed me formation in a really sweet way. And so I would just encourage the mom who is saying, does it really matter? Is it really worth it? These just feel so silly. That again, think of what you've heard in this conversation and say that these are the tools that are going to be necessary, that are going to have them delight in these books that I know for all of us who are so giddy. And we want to have the discussion with our teenage son about the Odyssey. Or we want to be talking to them about Dante, and we're just like ready to go. But we cannot do that if we skip this stage. I mean, that's how crucial it is. And so I'm not saying that your teenager is going to love all of those books. But I'm saying that this is the path that we have to take to ensure that there is a taste for it. And then we spread the feast. And so I think that is something I wish I would have known more, because when we jump to formal lessons, I realized very quickly, y'all can look in our text thread and remember that we didn't have enough myths and fables, because jumping to Tales of Troy and Greece was a big jump for my oldest. So I kept reading it, but I really had to supplement with some other myths and fables and all of that, because he just didn't have enough of the language to be able to follow. And so that was something I wish I would. So again, my youngest is having a very different education than his brother is, but that's part of it too, is that you're learning and they're all learning and none of it's wasted.
Definitely. I want to jump on what you said about how children receive the world that you give them, because a question that I get quite a bit, and I'm going to throw at you guys, is, well, then we should give them the real stories that show them the real world, right? Because if we are giving them a world, what good is Narnia when they don't live in Narnia, right? I need to give them real stories that show them the real world so they'll be really prepared for all the real things coming their way. Again, using Milne's capital letters there quite all the way through. So when we think about story and its otherworldly elements, particularly with these ideas of fables and fairy tales, myths and legends, how do they bring clarity to a child's understanding of this world?
Yeah, you know, I don't think any of us can say it better than C.S. Lewis. So I'm just going to go straight for the man, the myth, the legend himself. So I just finished reading his book, Experiment and Criticism. And he says this, he says, "No one can deceive you unless he makes you think he is telling the truth. The unblushingly romantic has the far less power to deceive than the apparently realistic. Admitted fantasy is precisely the kind of literature which never deceives at all. Children are not deceived by fairy tales. They are often and gravely deceived by school stories. Adults are not deceived by science fiction. They can be deceived by the stories in the women's magazine." That idea that when with a fantasy story, we're not lying to our children saying, oh, Narnia is real. It's really a real place that you could travel by wardrobe. You know, if you could find the wardrobe somewhere on Earth, you could get there. Like, none of us are doing that. We're not telling our children that it's, you know, and we might play with them and be like, you know, in Narnia, you know how things are.
I do that.
We do it very tiny. Yes. Okay, well, maybe I need to take back everything I just
said. At my house, I do this.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. Okay, let me rephrase then. Our children do know that we're not talking to them the same way we talk when we talk about Jesus Christ crucified, buried, and resurrected. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a tone difference at a minimum, even if you are talking about the Pevensies like they are real people. Because yes, we do. Definitely in my house, we'll talk about certain characters like they're real people. So I'm not saying that there's, you know, it's like completely black and white. But what I am saying is there is an atmospheric difference between how we talk about those things. We do it with a smile in a way that our children can pick up on the fact that we're not talking about historical fact, right? The way we are about other things. So I don't really think it's like a true concern. I don't know anyone who's actually like been reading these stories and had this issue. So I feel like this honestly is more of an issue someone has when they haven't read the stories yet. And so there's a fear of like, oh, like, am I lying to my kids, or I'm reading these fairy stories and then they're going to be confused. And once you do it, you're like, well, of course not. Like, that's, you know, our children are intelligent. They can pick up on what's real and what's not real. But with that, I would just also add, I lost my train of thought. I had one more thought, but it's gone. So you'll just have to all wonder and be left in the mystery.
It's because you threw out your Lewis. Whenever I'm asked that question, I always quote that exact section of Lewis, but I'm getting lazier as I answer it. And I'm only like, well, you know how Lewis said, and I throw out like a portion of it. And my husband first would be like, you know, not everyone thinks C.S. Lewis is just a mic drop. Like, you can't just quote him and think you've made a point. And now it's like, you're not even fully quoting him. You're just saying, well, C.S. Lewis said that thing about the women's magazine. Remember?
You get the point.
Right? Like, you can't give that as a reason for this. But I can, and I will continue to, as did Amanda Foss. Brooke, did you want to add any things? I know you really care about this as well.
Yeah, I would just say that, well, one example that just happened, I mean, 2 days ago, is, like I said, I had to up our intake of myths and fairy tales and all of those things that may be concerning for the mom at the beginning stage, right? Because again, assuming that you are having, you know, daily intake of the Bible, and right, any mom who is sitting down to read and is thinking about this is a mom that wants to do the right thing. Like, it is no mom who is listening to this podcast thinking, how can I deceive my child and really confuse them? Like, so I think that it's from a good place, but what I have witnessed is that moms have potentially waited too long, right? So they withheld the myths, the fairy tales, the magic, and then now they're wanting to introduce them to their teenagers, and they're wondering, now is it okay? Or now are they going to think it's weird? Like, those appetites still have to, the taste still has to be cultivated. Again, those tools of learning have to be given. And so, but just an example that we had 2 days ago. So I increased our myths, and we're reading about the Greek gods. So Zeus, Aphrodite, all of the things, and we're into it. And then my son comes out from his rest time and just very serious, right? Now, this is the stage that he is also in. So not so much ages and stages, but just developmentally, everything's black and white. It's very concrete. And he comes out and he goes, they believed that these gods were real. And so I am not going to say yes or no. I'm just going to ask a question. Well, tell me more about that. What did they think? Like, explain what, because again, I want him to tell me what he's thinking, because what I'm hearing him say may not be what he's actually thinking and processing. So he just goes on to say, they were sacrificing and praying to these gods, but don't they know the one true God? You know, this was in Greece. And so, of course, he's not following a timeline of like when these were written and all of that as to when the Bible made it to Greece and all of those things. So, but then his next follow-up question before I could even answer was, this is why Paul had to go to Greece. So I said very little. his mind was just kind of connecting the dots. I still haven't really given an answer of like, yeah, they were all pagan. And, you know, what do you think about that? You know, it's like, no, because again, like he's processing, he's still thinking about it. But I think that that was such a clear example where the faithfulness just to keep giving the story, right, with the right amount of Bible, with the right amount of our family culture and prayers and all of those things with these stories, he didn't come out really confused about is Zeus God or is God God? It was, you know, the opposite. So I'm not saying that that's true of every child, but I'm just saying I think a lot of the concern is that that's going to be confusing. Well, if Greek has a God and we have a God and they have a God, but actually it did the opposite where I saw it, what Stratford Caldecott said, that it gave him a deeper insight into what was real. And so it just wasn't a concern that I think we originally on the onset might think it's going to be a concern.
Oh, I was just going to say, I'm remembering the thing that I forgot earlier. It came to my mind as Brooke was talking. But the other really cool thing about fairy tales, even fantasy stories, is that you get to find out which pieces of reality are movable and which ones are not. Yeah. So, and I think that's a really interesting thing for kids, right? So like in another fantasy world, there might not be gravity, right? Like people can fly or, you know, you can go through a magical wardrobe and time and space are bent and changed. That can be altered and that's okay. But what can't change is being a liar. Like when you go to the fantasy world, it's not suddenly okay to murder or suddenly okay to betray your family, right? And so there are through this changing of scene, your children get a deeper insight. I think this is what Stratford Caldecott means when he said you get a deeper insight into reality, because you get to find out what are the immovable parts of reality that have to be true in every world. And that if we were to remove those pieces, suddenly chaos would break out. Because now, you know, and of course we live in the time of the modern novel, which is doing this all the time, and it's so destructive. And so I think, you know, that's something that I'm really thankful for as I read these stories to my children, as we get to, whether it's with the fairy tales where we're seeing those dynamics, or like what you're describing, Brooke, with myths, where I just read the story of Pandora and her box a couple weeks ago to my kids, and they quickly picked up on the allusions to the Garden of Eden and, you know, having these children in paradise who open, you know, chaos and, you know, envy and all these evil things. And so I think there's just a really beautiful and exciting thing, like you're talking about with your son, even though you haven't gone all the way into the conversation yet, to get to talk with our kids about, look at these stories and how they point to Christ. Like these people were, yes, pagans, and yet they were having these stories where there's always these elements of the gospel, but like one piece that's really important and it's missing, right? And so there's always just a little something that if they had the full picture, they would have the gospel. And so getting to show our children how so many of these stories are these puzzle pieces that if you put them together, suddenly you are shown Christ, like the logos, the mythos of creation, the one who all of these things come together. It's like this, we're giving our children a mystery that they don't even know yet. And it's like this gift that they're going to unwrap later. And so it's when, as a mom, when you know the mysteries that are there and you know the stories and the images and what's going on there, you're just sitting there like excited, like, did they notice? Because it's so exciting and beautiful and amazing how Christ was the fulfillment of all these things, even to the pagans. And now all of human history has been changed. And now, it would be laughable to believe in the Greek gods, right? It would be a joke. And yet, absolutely, people used to really think these things. And so there's just so much beauty in it that, you know, I feel for the child who misses out on those things. And I see how then, you know, it carries through to their future reading, that if you don't have these building blocks of stories, you'll actually miss out on a lot later, whether it's really the great books themselves, but even many modern novels, great writers are constantly borrowing from the past. And so if you want to understand literature, any good literature, you really do need these stories, because they're the building blocks of all the other stories, just because by virtue of being the oldest, most of the things we mentioned, they now we have them in written form, but they mostly started out as oral traditions, if not all, as I'm thinking about, they all started out as oral traditions. And I think the one thing we didn't mention was poetry. So definitely also add in poetry, because it's very important.
I was just going to say, that's a really good point, is that, but so one question, and I think Autumn, you might be good at answering this because of you are your home librarian and you find the best books. But it's really trying to find what Amanda was just talking about, that there is a shift that happened here in the last, you know, couple of years, depending on, you know, however long that has been. But the fairy tales that I grew up on, you know, I'm 30 something now. So as a millennial, everything was Disney-fied. So I truly thought that these were the fairy tales and the fables and all of that. And so when I read Cinderella for the first time, Beauty and the Beast from Grimm, I was like, what is happening? And so there can be, right? I was not given the tools. And so my obsession with all of this is an adult one, and it's worse. So just give the tools to your children at the appropriate time. But Autumn, like, how would you, because you have answered this for me, how do we go about finding the truest, you know, fairy tales that do not blur the lines, that have reality and truth and all of that in there, and make sure we're not giving them the modern ones that really do blur the lines, and we don't know who is good and evil, and we don't know all of that, because you don't want to be reading those to your kids, where it's very confusing about who is good and who is bad, which is most children's books in your library today. Not yours, but the public library.
I love that you, not my library. No, I know what you mean, generally in the library. I love that you just flipped the microphone on me on my own podcast. Yes. Okay. So first and foremost, because I do think this is a question when you're like, I'm so inspired by listening to these two amazing women. Now, what do I do? First is to go to the list. We are inheriting a tradition. In fact, yes, the three of us were talking about earlier today that if you were trying to be unique and out on your own, you're doing it wrong. Like, you are supposed to be inheriting the wisdom of the past. And that includes the book list. Amanda and I both have a strong interest in this man named John Senior, and he has the 1000 Good Books list. And I'm hoping Amanda will tell us more about the project she's been working on with it in a bit. And he is making the argument that you cannot engage with the really good, great books of Western civilization if you've not had this reading life that has built into that. And it includes all these things we're talking about for the early years. And so I give that list out all of the time as a starting place. Go find where you are on this list, find where your child has read to on this list, and just keep going from there. There are other lists that you can find from classical educators, because the library list is long for the Western catalog of good books. Not every book is a great book. Not every book is excellent, but there are a lot of good books to start on as well. And I just reference those books. I've never left those lists. I'm still using those lists. They've become the path that I'm wanting to walk. But what I found also is that as you read from those lists, your own taste in reading will change. Your beauty sense, your appetitive taste, your awareness of how stories are told will change. So that then when you do pick up something, maybe you find an old fairy tale book at a library book sale and you're not sure exactly where the collection's from, how old it is or anything, you can tell by the language, maybe the illustrations, or you read one of them very quickly and you know, oh no, this is maybe post-Enlightenment, or this is too modern. It's totally messing up the storyline here. This isn't right. I know an example for me was I found a very old copy of, I'm not going to say his last name right. Is it Charles Perrault? Is that how you say it?
I say Perrault, but I'm sure that's not Perrault? Right. You're probably right. It's, I mean, like, you know French? I don't know French.
I don't know French. No, I'm not Charles a master to that degree.
Like the California.
No. Okay, so it's spelled like Perrault. Someone is dying listening to us right now about how you say that. But I found this really old copy, and I recognized the name, but I had not yet, I had not heard Angelina Stanford talk about what happened with the fairy tales with him. I didn't know any of this yet, but I bought this book, very excited. I read through Little Red Riding Hood, and I'm totally confused on why this is the edition I should be reading to my children. Aloud? No, thankfully I was reading it to myself. I couldn't tell if I was stuck in my own modern mind. So I was reading into the text, this weird undertone in the wolf, and I wasn't sure what was going on, but I didn't like it. I couldn't find the Christ figure. I couldn't find the redemptive story that's supposed to be reflected in fairy tales. I was really confused. And then actually someone in Common House, shout out to Taylor, she sent me something that was like, I've heard Angelina Stanford say you shouldn't read those, and here's why. So I listened to the Literary Life podcast on this, and basically he was scrubbing the fairy tales of their kind of Christological references and understanding so that he could apply them to the modern day court. And there was a problem in the court of powerful men seducing young girls in this very wolf-like way, which happens in the fairy tale, the way he changed it. But just because I had been reading deeply in these books and in this fairy tale tradition, I knew that when I got to that, something was off, but I didn't know what yet. And I think that's some of the comfort of the reading life, is you're constantly finding your own kind of North Star. Scripture, of course, should be the main thing directing your compass. That's one of the most helpful things you can give yourself or your children. And then you'll be able to compare all stories and your moral and mythic imagination to Scripture. But at the same time, reading from these lists of good books will allow you to start standing on your own feet when you engage with an old book you find that you don't really have a reference point for. So trust the list, inherit the tradition, be grateful, and don't spit on it. And then as you read, trust that you will change, like your ideas, your mind, they will change your mind and your soul. So that would be my tip. Amanda, what do you want to say?
I was just going to add to that. So in defense of Charles Perrault, he is in a long literary tradition of changing fairy tales. So this is a thing people do. C.S. Lewis did it with Till We Have Faces. So what I will say is, do not read Charles Perrault to your third grader. Yes. But consider maybe by middle school. It's a good literary device to see how, with something as familiar as a very simple folktale like Little Red Riding Hood, and see, okay, now this author had a different message. He wanted to change this fairy tale that we all know and love. Which, of course, what most people don't realize is there's actually like 7 different versions of Little Red Riding Hood. The whole red thing actually came from Charles Perrault. She was like Little Golden Hood or something like that before.
Yeah.
But the point being that this is a thing writers do. I mean, Hans Christian Andersen is in that tradition. Where people get confused with Charles Perrault is he, in like the timeline, was before the Grimm's brothers. So people think, oh, he was the oldest. No, because he was taking these old oral traditions and changing them for a purpose, whereas the Grimms are a more faithful rendition of the fairy tales because their actual purpose was to record these oral traditions. And because they were, you know, faithful Christians, they were specifically looking for the Christ figure, the ones that told the greatest story ever told. And so that's where Grimms are really just always the best place to start. And what I'll say is, better the book you have than the book you don't. Like, if you have a version of Grimm's, do not panic. Like, I have some really pretty copies of Grimm's that, yes, now that I've gotten, like, the translation that John Senior recommends, do I see the differences? I do. They are often subtle, so it's not necessarily always a huge deal. But, you know, in the span of time, do I prefer that I now have what I think is a better translation? Yes. Do I think we were, like, you know, majorly harmed by starting with a more modern translation? No, like the heart of the story. C.S. Lewis talks about the mythic component of stories. And his point is that stories that have a mythic quality, you could basically give like a 3-sentence summary of that story and it could still impact you, right? Versus you could take an entire long poetry, you know, a ballad to tell the story and it will still also impact you. But actually the power is in this mythic story, not in how it's being told. And I honestly think many fairy tales fall in that category, so that we can actually relax a little bit. As long as they are keeping the main characters and keeping certain main components, but we're going to find the Christ figure. We're going to see how they are redemptive and they're going to point us on the path to truth. And so, I don't know. It's a hard thing as a classical homeschool mom because you're always wanting to buy more books. And I do always buy more books. So I can't tell someone else to be better than me, but if I could encourage, I would try to say, don't feel bad if you don't have the money to buy the book. It's okay to use the one you
have. Right. No, I think that's actually something that needs to be said, particularly because this conversation, I did want to gear towards the moms with the younger kids who haven't started formal school. And it can, I think I remember being there, Brooke, we've talked about this. It can feel so overwhelming. You're like, yes, we're going to read fairy tales. And you maybe ran out and I don't want to say you went to Barnes and Noble because those probably aren't going to be great, but you just have a random copy of Grimm's around. And then you hear someone as lovely as Amanda get deep into fairy tales. You're like, no, I have the wrong Grimm's. And you panic and you think you're doing everything wrong, but you're not. You are learning alongside of your child. As long as, again, you stick to that kind of list where you're like, oh, I should be reading Grimm's. Excellent. That's fantastic. Start there. You will continue to learn as an educator. Your appetites, your appetitive tastes will continue to grow. And you keep doing this with your children. You're not going to be the same fairy tale reader with your fifth child as you were with your first. Hopefully we have all learned things to Brooke's point about how different her second start will be with her second son. We keep learning and that's all good. It doesn't mean what we did before wasn't right. And so I did want to say that because I think it's so true. It's such a good point you landed on. Okay. So on the way out here, because I am so grateful to have you here. And I know that you both have really fun upcoming projects, both public facing and then in your local community. So on the way out, will you each tell us about those projects and if there's anywhere that we can find you to follow along?
Brooke, you go.
Okay. Well, I am just normal. And I actually, am transitioning to more of just a home base. And so we have just moved to, well, it's been about a year, but still just moved. So as at the front end, when Autumn was saying the last time we were on, we were talking about starting a co-op. Well, I have since moved. So that co-op is still up and running and doing a great, great work in Georgia. But I am working boots on the ground to try to start a co-op here locally. And my first leg is starting a book club. So I'm just trying to wrangle the wildlings of just who will read some of these books with me and just putting out the call to see who will gather. And so we are in a very transient community. We are in a military community, which is new to our family. And so there's a lot of transition every couple of years. I mean, people are stationed here, most likely a lot of homeschool people, but they are here 18 months to 3 years, and then they go, you know, somewhere else. And so just trying to realize and really live into that rhythm of, okay, where has God planted my feet? What is the work that he's given to our family? And how do I best bring these ideas to the people who are in front of me? Because I don't know about y'all, I think more than ever, people are opened to the reality of home education in a very exciting way. Amanda, I know that you were homeschooled, but I just, almost every week, I am talking to another mom who's considering it, wants to try it, feeling nervous about it. And so just really trying to put myself in a place where I can cultivate some of those conversations and relationships just in a face-to-face way and be a service and a help to where God has put me. And so, so that's what right this second in this season, my work looks mostly like here at home and with my husband, with his, with our church plan. So
I love wonderful. That because Amanda. No classical life exists apart from community. I think that's a very important thing. While many of us maybe start out having to look on the internet for friends, you know, that's how we all met. And I'm so thankful we did. Yet if we don't take the encouragement and the blessing of what we three talk about and then go back to our real lives and have those same type of conversations with our friends and in the communities we're trying to build at home, it's just super important and super necessary. I'm doing a similar thing. I have a co-op. We're expanding it into an all-day school starting next year. And we have a vision within the next 3 to 5 years to make it a 3-day hybrid program. So I'm very excited about that. But as far as things where people listening to this podcast could participate, if you're in the San Bernardino County, you know, reach out because maybe you too could join our co-op. Brooke stepped away from the Wonder Years podcast after season one due to all these wonderful things happening in her life and in her ministry. After that happened, I was praying about, thinking about, well, what do I do? Like, I want the Wonder Years to continue, but what is this going to look like? And my husband graciously accepted my invitation and request for him to join me. So really, anyone who knows me knows that the moment I started doing all these online things for classical education, I've been in my husband's ear like, so when are we doing this together? When are we doing this together? Because we share this love of classical education together. Our stories are very different. He honestly identifies a lot more with someone like Brooke coming from a public education background. And yet our different backgrounds have given us both a mutual zeal to see this education for all people. And so that's, you know, happening in our local community that we're working on that together. But now we're using the Wonder Years podcast as some sort of a platform to launch some other things that we're really passionate and excited about. So one of those things is the curriculum I mentioned. It's not going to be out anytime soon, so don't get too excited. But I am working on it behind the scenes. Brooke is beta testing it with me, so it's going to be wonderful. With that, we do have a Substack. So on that Substack, you can find articles. I'm currently doing a series on poetic knowledge. Poetic knowledge is just so good, guys. So for nothing else, the articles are free. Go to the Substack, read the articles on poetic knowledge. Behind the paywall for $5 a month, we do have what is called Wonder Tales. And so Wonder Tales are a bi-monthly podcast that I do where I walk through fairy tales and folk tales like Little Red Riding Hood, where we take a story that is a common story you'll be reading to your children. But like Brooke said, a lot of times you come to this as an adult and you don't know why are we reading these stories? Like, I don't understand. Like, there was that really weird part where the evil stepsisters got their eyes pecked out. Like, that seems like a bit much. Like, and so we're going to talk about those stories. And what I'm going to try to do is show you the images, the metaphors, the themes that are in these stories that really most of all point to Christ and the redemption of the world, that then can give you the excitement and confidence as a parent to then go back to those stories with your children and read them aloud and just know that, oh, I'm giving my child something that is going to form their soul in truth, goodness, and beauty. And so it's kind of a go fight win speech for fairy tales and folk tales. I'm really excited about that. So both of those things are on the Wonder Years Substack. And other than that, we're on Instagram. So you can get any updates on any of those things if you follow us at Wonder Years Podcast.
And I will make sure all of that is linked in today's episode notes. Also, Amanda, I was just thinking you should do one of your Wonder Tales with Emily Thomas. I think the two of you talking about a story would blow everyone's minds. Emily was on the podcast last season, and we're all in Common House hanging out together. And she does a similar thing with picture books where she searches out those things. And I just think my brain would explode listening to the two of you. Wonder Tales is going to be my pre-prep for fairy tales, folk tales for the fall for my kids. So I'm following along with Amanda's projects as well. And I hope you guys will consider joining me over there to continue to learn from her. Ladies, thank you so much for being here. I was delighted to be talking about something that fits so well with your conversations last year, and I could bring you back because I love learning from both of you. And I'm so glad you were able to come on today.
Oh, we love you so much. And I don't think anybody who listens to this podcast doesn't know, but you are an incredible heart and soul and mind, and your love for God and the way you are taking your time and talents and investing it into furthering classical education in our country. Like, I just think how much good is happening in the world. And I mean, I am in the point in my life where I have people send me your stuff and are like, hey, have you seen this? And I'm like, have I seen it? I'm like, I would like you to know, but I try not to boast because that's rude in a sense. So, but
you're like, I proofread that for her.
Yes. And I would just say, as we end, that if you found any of this just a little bit encouraging, then you need to come and join us in Common House. If you love the things that Autumn does on the podcast, she does even more. It is insane. The classes, the guides, the Q&As that she does behind Common House. It is the only resource I give to people until Amanda's resource is out and ready, her curriculum. These two women are doing the work for God's people in their lanes that is really cultivating and equipping this generation of moms. And I am the most blessed because of it. So these two women are two of the smartest women that I know, but not only that, are two of the most godly. And so it is just a joy to get to know y'all and to see you both living in the way God has made you that is actually benefiting not only other women, but like my very own family. So thank you for the work y'all are doing.
Hey, girls, I did not want to involve the commonplace audience in our friend love fest at this moment, but I'm so glad you were all here. Everyone else, I will see you in 2 weeks.